Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, May 3rd. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from the Joint Replacement Center at Adirondack Health in Saranac Lake, providing tailored orthopedic procedures and rehabilitation to residents of Northern New York. Better health, better lives, AdirondackHealth.org. Joining us for Medical Monday today is Dr. Lisa Curcio of Nuvance Health. She's on the line to answer your breast surgery questions. And if you do have a question, give us a call early. It tends to be a busy program. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Lisa Curcio and your breast surgery questions coming up on Vox Pop after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday today is Dr. Lisa Curcio of Nuvance Health. Dr. Curcio joined Nuvance to establish a breast surgery program at Northern Dutchess Hospital in Rhinebeck. She came from Memorial Care Medical Group and was medical director of surgical services at BreastLink in Laguna Hills, California. She specializes in both oncology and breast surgery. Dr. Curcio completed a surgical oncology fellowship at City of Hope, a national medical center in California, and a general surgery residency and internship at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Dr. Curcio was a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force, where she was the chief of surgical oncology at Kiesler Medical Center at Kiesler Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi. If you have a question for Dr. Curcio, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But the number to call is 800-348-2551. Dr. Lisa Curcio, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you here. Now, we read in your bio that you yourself have had breast cancer, and if you don't mind sharing with us, how has that experience changed you as a surgeon and a doctor?
So, as I think all of us go into medicine with the hopes that we're going to help people and we're not going to need to be helped by a lot of the things that we train for. I was affected at a very young age by cancer. My grandfather died when I was in fifth grade. And initially, I wanted to be a medical oncologist. And then when I went to medical school and did my surgical rotation, really fell in love with surgery. I ultimately was led by my mentors to combine the two, and I was encouraged to do a fellowship in surgical oncology, which is the surgery of all types of organs to remove if they have cancer. And so that's what I did my training, and after my fellowship, I actually had a military obligation, a health profession scholarship, and was stationed in Biloxi, Mississippi. About a year and a half after I was there, I had my first child, and about 9 months after I had my son, I had some breast symptoms and diagnosed my own breast cancer. At that time, I was doing all types of cancer surgery, colon, liver, melanoma, and breast also. And I was treated in the military and actually got great treatment through the military service. And then after I completed my my obligation to the military, came back to California. And it took a little time, about a year or two, for me to really start to realize that this was really my calling. I felt like the care for breast cancer patients was left a lot to be imagined in terms of really a patient-centered approach. And because of my surgical oncology training, I felt like I could provide that. So after about 4 to 5 years with the general surgery group, I opened my own practice and really dedicated the rest of my career towards the surgery of breast cancer patients and the benign diseases of the breast.
You know, this might be difficult to answer in a concrete way, but I'm curious as to what perspective you gained. In other words, many doctors, I assume, around the world end up being diagnosed with something that's a specialty of theirs. But when you're in medical school, you learn many, many things, I would imagine, and most of them are scientific and there are techniques and things like that. But what perspective did you get on breast cancer that you didn't get in medical school that you got when you got the diagnosis?
That's a great question. And I don't think no matter how much you can hear what patients explain to you, until you're on that other side of the table and you're getting the diagnosis and you're trying to process through what your choices are and you're on that stretcher going to the operating room, you can't experience or really have an appreciation for that side of it. And so being on both sides, I really feel it gives me a tremendous perspective for what the patient goes through. Case in point, I had to wait over 2.5 weeks for my pathology results after my definitive surgery, and it's an anguishing waiting time to find out, you know, what you might be up against, additional treatments, because that pathology report really dictates a lot of subsequent treatments after surgery. And, you know, just understanding what a patient experiences when they're waiting for these reports and everything seems to hang in the balance of the results of that report. There's no way you can really appreciate it unless you've gone through it.
We're joined today by Dr. Lisa Curcio of New Vance Health, and our number is 800-348-2551. All right, doctor, let's grab at least one call here before our first break. We go to Linda in Berkshire County. Linda, you're on. Go ahead. Hello, Linda. We're losing Linda. All right, well, if Linda calls back, we will go to Linda. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
How effective is removal of the axillary lymph nodes in cases of metastatic cancer?
Did you get that?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of that question.
How effective is removal of the axillary lymph nodes in cases of metastatic cancer?
That's called a dissection, a lymph node dissection. So for breast cancer, we remove the lymph nodes underneath the armpit to determine whether or not the cancer from the breast has traveled to those lymph nodes, and that's called a lymph node dissection.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. We appreciate the call. Dr. Lisa Curcio is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You mentioned when you were diagnosed, how far along was the cancer, and could you have perhaps found it earlier with an earlier mammogram?
So I was 37 when I was initially diagnosed with breast cancer, and certainly I had had one prior mammogram before that, just as a baseline, which at that time we recommended a baseline at the age of 35, and that was completely normal. So according to the recommendations at that time, I would not have had another mammogram to the age of 40. Because I had just had a child, I was breastfeeding, and one night I was pumping and actually noted some blood in the container that was collecting the milk. And so I pursued that with a mammogram, which showed calcifications, which are tiny specks of calcium on the mammogram. The interesting thing for me is a lot of the calcifications on the mammogram were what we would consider benign calcifications, maybe related to breastfeeding and the changes that are associated with that. But there were some changes that were more suspicious, and so I went on to have a biopsy of those calcifications, which in my case showed what we call ductal carcinoma in situ, or DCIS, and that's stage 0 breast cancer. but I had a lot of it. I had over 8 centimeters of calcifications, and so it was unclear how much of that was just the contained cancer and whether or not there was some invasive cancer in those calcifications. So that's why the final pathology report was so critical for knowing whether I would need something like chemotherapy after my treatment, after my surgical treatment.
In your estimation, and there has been some controversy about the timetable and the schedule and the age for mammograms, is it about right now?
No, as a matter of fact, not. I think that there are a lot of varied recommendations out there, and it's very easy for the average person to be confused. I think a lot of physicians are confused because the task force came out, a government-led group, recommending that we don't start screening till the age of 50, and we only screen from age 50 to 75 every other year. And there's a lot of controversy whether that really captures at-risk groups, including that group between age 40 to 50. And so most organizations like the American Cancer Society and NCCN do recommend starting screening at age 40, and some recommend every other year, but our society, the American Society of Breast Surgeons, recommends yearly mammograms starting at the age of 40 and continuing because some people live to 90. So if we stop at age 75, we can be watching and waiting for that cancer to develop instead of identifying it before we can actually feel it. So really looking at patients' medical history, longevity in their family, and individualizing whether patients should continue screening after the age of 75, dependent on those factors.
Dr. Lisa Curcio joins us on today's Medical Monday. We'll take a quick break, doctor, and then we'll hit the phones once again. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. Vox Pop, it's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Dr. Lisa Curcio of Nuvance Health joins us on the line today to talk about breast health and breast surgery. And let's go to the elusive Linda in Berkshire County. Linda, are you with us?
Hi, can you hear me?
You betcha. Go ahead.
Hi. Okay. I just had a mammogram and they found stuff they can't identify. I just said, oh, that's interesting. What is this stuff? And they want to go in there and operate. I don't know. I'm just asking this doctor, what would you do if they told you, we don't know what it is, but we want to go in there? I'm saying, okay, that's it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Linda. Doctor.
So, that sounds kind of a non-definitive plan. In general, when we go in surgically, we know what we're going for and we have an idea of what the diagnosis is. So sometimes it does pay to get a second opinion, to take your mammograms to another facility that has a specialist such as myself, where we just do breast cancer surgery and really go over what your risk factors are, what the mammogram looks like, how does it compare to prior mammograms, and then really decide, is it right to go to surgery, or should we do maybe an additional test like an ultrasound or a breast MRI or even a biopsy to try to get an idea of what it is that we might be going after surgically or whether it really even needs surgery.
Well, thank you so much.
Linda,
thank you. I hope that answers your question.
Linda, thanks for the call. Dr. Lisa Curcio joins us today on Vox Pop Medical Monday. 800-348-2551 is the number. Cheryl in Lake George. Hello, Cheryl.
Hi, how are you?
Good, you're on.
Okay, in 2011, I had a diagnosis of stage 1 invasive ductal carcinoma. I had a mastectomy with reconstruction, and the implant was the gummy bear. And mm-hmm. my concern is now it's in the, you know, it was in the news that this is a small concern. And my question is this something that I should at this point be looking into possible more reconstruction, or if I should just do a wait and see? So that's my question.
Okay.
Cheryl, that's a great question. There is a lot of controversy about current implants, and particularly this entity of what they call textured implants, because they can be associated with a very small risk of a implant-associated lymphoma. But usually these implant-associated lymphomas are symptomatic in that they create a fluid layer between the chest wall and the implant, and that can be seen on imaging. Rest assured that the majority of these implant-related lymphomas are treated with surgery just by removing the implant, and it usually goes away. In general, our plastic surgeons are not recommending routine removal of the implant unless there's other indications, like perhaps the implant has been there for a long period of time and it has other reasons. There might be other reasons that the implant needs to be replaced, because we know implants don't last forever. But in general, just going in because you're concerned about this low-risk lymphoma is not generally recommended by most plastic surgeons. However, I always recommend that patients consult with either the plastic surgeon who did their original surgery or another plastic surgeon, if that plastic surgeon is no longer around, and discuss what the options are for your particular case. We can do imaging, something as simple as an ultrasound, making sure that there's no fluid around the implant that might be early signs of this implant-related lymphoma.
Okay. And a real quick follow-up question. You said they don't last forever. Is there a kind of a time, when I should be considering being concerned about how long it's been in there?
That's a great question, because a lot of the problems with the implants from the 70s were that the capsule, so the shell that contained the silicone, was very thin. And so over time, that capsule thinned out, and then it started leaking the silicone. But in those days, the silicone was liquid, so then that silicone was able to leach into the tissue and cause siliconosis and all kinds of problems. Nowadays, the silicones, the gummy bear implants, and other related implants, they're more semi-solid. They're more like Jell-O in that if you were to cut into the capsule of that implant, it doesn't leak out into the tissue. It's not a liquid per se. Yet, generally, we say that the life of an implant is 10 years, and that's what the FDA approves them for. But a lot of people that have had breast cancer surgery don't want to have to go every 10 years to have that implant replaced. So, again, that's a discussion between the patient and the plastic surgeon. What's the best and optimal time to have that implant replaced, just to make sure that there are no problems with that capsule?
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Cheryl, thank you very much for the call. It's Medical Monday. We are joined today by Dr. Lisa Curcio of New Vance Health. She specializes in both oncology and breast surgery. Our number is 800-348-2551. Jesse's on the road. Hello, Jesse. You're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about my best friend of 50 years. We're both 72. She was diagnosed about a month ago with stage one breast cancer, and they did a lumpectomy about 3 weeks ago. And she has met with the radiation oncologist, and also she has an appointment to discuss hormone therapy, estrogen, I forget what it's called, but basically
estrogen blockers.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Right. So we've been having this discussion for a few weeks, along with some friends who also had breast cancer. And she is really at odds about what to do. She was told basically that she had a 1 in 10 chance of reoccurrence if she didn't do one or the other, or that she could do nothing at 72 and just wait and see what happens. So I'm just calling to get some advice from you to pass on to her if you have any.
This is a great question, Jesse. Your friend is 72 and has a stage 1 breast cancer, and the survival rate for stage 1 breast cancer is 98%+, as long as it's contained within the breast. Now, in general, in a younger woman...
Let me interrupt just for a second. Her margins were also clear. It never went into her lymph nodes or anything. Sorry,
correct.
So I thought you should have that.
She has an excellent prognosis for her breast cancer. So, in a younger person who has a stage 1 breast cancer, we certainly would discuss radiation therapy and endocrine therapy. We do know, in this era of individualized medicine, not everyone needs every modality. And we do know that as women get over 65 years of age and older, that the benefit to radiation is just to reduce the risk that it comes back in the breast. The radiation really does not improve the overall survival for someone who's over 65 with a localized breast cancer like your friend has. So that could be debatable whether she really needs radiation therapy, and she should be offered the opportunity to not do radiation therapy. However, if we are going to skip that modality, then we do encourage patients to take the endocrine therapy, which is the anti-estrogen therapy. The endocrine therapy will not only help to reduce the risk of the recurrence in the breast, but any cancer cells that might be outside of the breast from them becoming a tumor later on. However, if she were to take that endocrine therapy and didn't tolerate it, I think, that would be a discussion between her and her physician, but she still may have an excellent survival. There has to be a consideration of quality of life, what the medications are doing in terms of side effects and her quality of life versus a small improvement in survival. So those are conversations that she should be having with her physician, and I would encourage her to ask those questions.
Okay. Thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
Jesse,
you're welcome. She has a great survival, so she's going to do well from her cancer regardless.
Jesse, thanks a lot for the call. Just to follow up on that, I'm fascinated. Why does the effectiveness of radiation therapy decrease for patients over 65?
That's a great question. Well, in general, women who are older tend to have more indolent tumors, diagnosed at an early stage, it doesn't seem to improve survival, particularly if they go on the anti-estrogen therapy. That seems to be enough to keep the cancer from recurring either in the breast or distantly.
Dr. Lisa Curcio joins us from New Vance Health today. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Drea and Troy is on. Hello.
Hello. I have a, like 20 years ago, I had a mammogram that showed calcifications, and I had a biopsy, and it showed that the calcifications were not a problem. I'm 68 years old. I take calcium for osteoporosis regularly. Is there any way that taking calcium for osteoporosis will affect the calcifications in breast tissue?
That's a great question, and it's a commonly asked question, and the answer to that question is no. Exogenous calcium to keep your bones healthy is important as we get older, but it does not cause calcifications in the breast. Things that can cause calcification in the breast that are benign are fibrocystic changes, breastfeeding, sometimes trauma. If you bump your breast and the breast is composed of fatty tissue and breast tissue, you can get this a little lump that's called fat necrosis, and that can get calcified. So there are lots of reasons that we can get benign calcifications in our breast, but taking a calcium supplement does not increase those. Also, just because you've had benign calcifications in the past does not mean that a new calcification might not be malignant. As I don't know if you heard earlier, but when I was diagnosed with my breast cancer, I had both benign and malignant calcifications. So when the radiologist looks at the calcifications, there are certain characteristics that will make them more concerned and want to biopsy certain calcifications over other benign appearing calcifications.
Okay. Thank you so much, Doctor. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday today with Dr. Lisa Curcio of New Vance Health. And we go to Lynn in Shelburne Falls. Lynn.
Hello?
Hello, you're on.
Oh, thank you. I have had breast implants, silicone breast implants, for 40 years. And one of my mammograms indicated that one of them might be leaking a little. They weren't sure, but apparently they weren't concerned. Is there something I should be concerned about?
That's a great question, Lynn. So according to my plastic surgeon colleagues, any implant that's been in for over 20 years, when they remove them, they'll find some evidence of the silicone leaking. And sometimes that's just contained within, you know, the breast forms a capsule around the implant. So sometimes that silicone leakage is contained, but over time that silicone can get into lymph nodes, and it can go various other places. So I would strongly encourage you to meet with the plastic surgeon to discuss removing those implants, especially if there's mammographic evidence, because that means that probably the amount of silicone that's leaking is a little bit more or might be outside of the capsule of the implant. So I would strongly encourage you to consider that. Sometimes you can just completely remove the implants and they can do a little bit of a lift on your breast and avoid putting another set of implants in, or sometimes they can be replaced with implants. But you do have options.
Okay, my insurance won't cover that, right?
Unfortunately, not in general.
Okay. Right. Thank you so much. You've been very helpful.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Lisa Curcio joins us today. And before we take our next break, Doctor, I wonder if you could just give us an update on the state of the art as far as detection goes. Is the mammogram is not the be-all, end-all, right?
Well, there is no test for any disease process that is the be-all, end-all, unfortunately. But we do know that screening mammogram is the best tool that we have for early detection, because as we spoke about earlier, if we detect a breast cancer before we can feel it and before it's gone to the lymph nodes, the survival rate is in the high 90 percentile. So it's very, very curable cancer. If we wait till we feel a cancer or it has other symptoms, then it's more likely that that will be a less curable cancer. Mammogram is not a perfect test, and if you have dense breast tissue, you should ask your physician to supplement the mammogram with ultrasound. The current technology is 3D mammography that is really the best modality out there for screening for cancer, which actually does a three-dimensional imaging of the breast. But if you have dense breast tissue, that should be supplemented with a ultrasound. Combined, a mammogram and ultrasound is extremely sensitive for detecting cancer at an early, early stage.
I assume, and I've not looked at the data specifically, but heredity plays an important part in this too. What about DNA markers?
So, yes, the era of genetic testing is definitely here, and we learn more about that every day. About 15 to 20% of breast cancers are what we consider hereditary, in that we inherit from either our mother or our father, which in the past we didn't think dad could give us risk for breast cancer, but we can inherit a gene that's broken and predispose us to various cancers. So nowadays, when I see a patient even for a benign problem. We do a very thorough three-generational family history to determine if they have risk based on their family history. And we might counsel that patient to have genetic testing, or if there are family members that have had breast cancer in the past that are still living, maybe we'll encourage them to get genetic testing of those family members.
Dr. Lisa Curcio joins us. Dr. Curcio, we'll take a quick break here, and then we'll hit the home stretch on the program. It's Medical Monday. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. Fox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Lisa Curcio of New Vance Health joins us today. And back to the phones we go. Amy is in Queensbury. Hi, Amy. You're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question. I was wondering, is diet directly related to preventing or helping to prevent breast cancer? And if so, what does that diet look like?
Great question, Amy. So there are a lot of things that we can do to actually reduce our risk of cancer in general and specifically breast cancer. So the things I counsel my patients, particularly if they are someone with a family history or have increased risk, are being at an optimal body weight, exercising regular, eating a healthy diet that includes fresh fruit and vegetables and tries to minimize animal protein. Avoiding alcohol and tobacco products, and reducing stress. Those are the things that we can do to reduce breast cancer risk and across the board, many other cancers.
That's great. I think that information out there is good for women to know. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Amy, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday with Dr. Lisa Curcio, and we go to Hyde Park, New York. Rita, you're on.
Hi, can you guys hear me okay?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, great. Yeah, hi. So I'm at a super high risk for breast cancer. My mother and grandmother had it, both postmenopausal. I'm in the menopause phase right now. Ooh, lucky me. And I'm not doing any HRT or replace, you know, nothing, like nothing at all as far as vitamins or drugs or any pharmaceuticals, nothing. So just wondering what menopause can do to increase your risk, or does it increase your risk, or what's the difference between postmenopausal and premenopausal breast cancer?
So premenopausal breast cancer is what occurs in younger women, and that tends to be usually a more aggressive cancer. As we get older and go through menopause and our estrogen levels go down, we usually women are diagnosed with what we call hormone sensitive. They're driven by estrogen, but they tend not to be as aggressive. Now, there are obviously exceptions to all rules, but in general, that's the difference between premenopausal and postmenopausal breast cancer. So premenopausal is younger age onset. So it's interesting because as a breast surgeon, a large part of my practice is a medical practice. So I actually see a lot of patients like yourself, Rita, who are at increased risk because they have family history. And what we do, number one, is we tease out what's that level of risk. If you had a mother and a grandmother who had breast cancer at 80, that's not as significant as if you had a mother and a grandmother who had breast cancer maybe in their early 50s. So when they had their breast cancer, or if one of them had bilateral breast cancer, that would be significant too. And we'd also look at what other cancers are in your family. And like I said earlier, we might recommend you do some testing to see if you inherited some genetic predisposition. We'd also look at what your personal factors are, you know, what age you had your first child, when your period started. And for you, good, you know, that you're not on hormone therapy, because that might be an additional thing that may increase your risk. And so what we do in our practice is we actually sit down with you and say, okay, this is your risk based on your family history and your personal factors, And here's what we can do to reduce your risk. We can do some of those lifestyle things that we just discussed. We can actually even put you on medication that can reduce your risk by up to 50%. And in people who are really high risk, like BRCA1 or 2 gene carriers who have a 90%, 80 to 90% lifetime risk of breast cancer, some of those women, we even talk about preventative surgery, reducing the risk of them developing a subsequent breast cancer. So each patient, it's a different treatment plan depending on what their risks are and what their sentiments are regarding that risk. And so we do an overall assessment, and then we recommend treatment and what your imaging should be. If you're at really high risk, we may want to add things like breast MRI to your mammogram and ultrasound, if that's what you're getting, just to supplement and make sure that we're not missing anything. So all of this can be kind of reviewed, and recommendations can be made.
Okay, wonderful. And you're in Rhinebeck, is that correct?
I'm in Rhinebeck and in Kingston. I'm happy to see you.
Perfect.
Well, thanks, Rita. We appreciate the call very much. Dr. Lisa Curcio joins us today from New Vance Health. 800-348-2551 is the number. Lyle is in Poughkeepsie. Lyle, you're on.
Yes, doctor. I would like to know what's the difference between thermography versus mammogram, and what's the advantage and are the disadvantage?
Okay.
That's an excellent question, Lyle. So thermography is actually a test that looks at heat that's given off by the breast. And it's a study that actually has been looked at for a long time and can have a certain value if you're looking, if there's a particular area of concern and you want to see if that area is metabolically more active than another. But there have been no studies to really show that thermography is actually a good screening modality for breast cancer. All of the studies seem to indicate that mammography really is the best screening test for mammography. As again, thermography can sometimes be used to problem solve certain areas, but it's not been shown to be a good screening modality for breast cancer.
My button didn't work here. Lyle, thank you very much for the call. Now we go to Gansevoort, New York. Stephen, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon, Dr. Curcio, Ray.
Hello.
Hi, Stephen.
So this call's partly just public service sort of question. I'm sure a lot of women and men listen to your show. I'm a lung specialist, actually, so breast cancer isn't what I deal with. But I did have a patient who came to see me who had had a breast cancer and was a man. Can you comment for the listening audience just regarding male breast cancer and whatever attention men should be paying to looking for this and watching for it?
Terrific.
And I'll listen on.
Stephen, thanks a lot. Great question.
It is a great question. You know, about 1% of all breast cancers are in men. So last year, about 2,600 men were diagnosed with breast cancer versus 270,000 women with breast cancer. That's an interesting statistic. It's also interesting to know that men are sometimes diagnosed later because we're not screening males for breast cancer. And men don't generally examine their breast. So sometimes it's not until there's pain or a symptom or note it maybe when washing in the shower. And so stage for stage, men's breast cancer has equal survival as women's breast cancer. The problem is because this is a population that we're not screening, or there's not, like you said, awareness about it, these patients tend to ignore symptoms, maybe think it's some gynecomastia as they're getting older, and don't seek medical care right away. Did that answer your question, Stephen?
Absolutely, yes. Stephen is no longer with us here. He hung up, but thank you very much for that. Dr. Lisa Curcio is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number on Medical Monday. And let's go to Barbara in Leverett, Massachusetts. Barbara.
Hi. How are you? Thank you so much for all that you do, Ray, with this program.
Thank
it's
you.
So good. My name is Barbara Seaman, and I wanted to ask about 30 or 40 years ago, a book came out called Women in the Crisis of Female Hormones. And I know that oral contraception now, the dosage is far less than it was back then. But can you talk a little bit about the effect of oral contraception on breast cancer?
Sure. Actually, we do know that oral contraceptives probably from the 70s, 80s, and probably early 90s were higher dose estrogen, and they may have had an impact on breast cancer diagnosis later on. And we do know that when you get exposed to a chemical or a toxin, it takes about, 10 to 20 years for that cancer to develop. So, we're probably seeing a lot of those cancers now or in the last 10 years. We do know nowadays that the birth control pills are much lower dose estrogen, and it is not felt that they are etiologic in breast cancer or play a role in that right now. As a matter of fact, a lot of studies have shown that in patients who have like the high-risk gene, the BRCA1 or 2 gene, we put them on birth control pills when they're very young to reduce the risk of ovarian cancer, and it doesn't seem to increase the risk of breast cancer. And we also know, obviously...
20 years, right?
I'm sorry?
But we won't know for 10 or 20 years, really?
Right. But the studies seem to indicate because these birth control pills now are much lower dosage that they probably do not cause breast cancer. But you're right. I mean, only time will tell. Once you get exposed to a chemical, it does take time for that cancer to actually develop. And we do know things like, obviously, hormone replacement, particularly combination hormone replacement, if taken for more than 7 years, is an additional additive risk factor for breast cancer. So the hormonal environment, both the patient's hormonal environment, how young they started having periods, when they stopped having periods, and whether they were exposed to birth control pills early on and hormone replacement later on, all of these are things that need to be considered in terms of what a woman's risk is for breast cancer.
Dr. Lisa Curcio joins us, and Kathy is in Saratoga. Kathy, you're on.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I recently heard that women should wait 3 months after their COVID vaccine to get a mammogram because there's been sightings of lymph node swelling, and I wanted to know if there's any data that you've read about that or your impressions.
Well, great question, Kathy. This is something like with everything with COVID, we're learning as we go. But yes, we are seeing, particularly on the side where the vaccine was given, that the lymph nodes do get swollen. And that's a reaction because the lymph nodes are doing what they need to be doing with the vaccine. But if you're getting a mammogram, that may alert the physician. As long as there's nothing going on in the breast, that radiologist will then just recommend a follow-up in 6 to 8 weeks to make sure that those lymph nodes go back down to normal-looking lymph nodes. So some of our societies, like the American College of Radiologists, have said if you're not overdue for your mammogram. So we do have a lot of people, because of the pandemic, that are overdue for their imaging. They should not delay with their vaccine. We'll just do a follow-up ultrasound of those lymph nodes. But if you had a mammogram last year and you can schedule it after maybe 6 weeks after your second vaccine, that would obviously eliminate the need to come back for an ultrasound if your lymph nodes are swollen.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm Amy, so I had one in each arm, so hopefully that'll help.
Okay.
All right,
Very
Kathy.
Very good.
Thanks a lot for the call. To Albany now, and Maureen. Albany and Maureen, you're on.
Yes, my question is concerning genetic testing. I know you discussed it, but I was diagnosed with, I have collateral breast cancer, and it has metastasized to the axilla, and 7 of the 12 lymph nodes were cancerous. Anyway, genetic testing has been recommended, and I would like to know the ethical obligation I have to notify extended family. I mean, I definitely would notify children, siblings, but what about first cousins? I'm reluctant to drop that on them if it turns out to be there's some genetic mutations.
Well, I think, you know, your conscience has to be the guide, but it certainly would be very powerful, especially if there are other women in your family that have had breast cancer, to know if you end up having a mutation, because a lot of these women, particularly the younger women, you know, they can do something preventative, or they can be followed more carefully and maybe prevent, you know, that cancer from occurring and not needing all of the treatment that perhaps that you went through. If you work with the genetic counselor, they have these form letters that you can they actually will give you, that you can just send to family members and kind of make them aware that they should test for a particular mutation. And it just gives them the information. And surprisingly, you know, some people act on it and some people don't. They just kind of tuck it away and don't do anything about that information. But it can be potentially life-changing for particularly younger people, knowing what their risk is and finding out if they're at that high-level risk. If you were to be found to have a mutation and then they tested and they were negative, then that risk is no longer a concern to them, so they could just have regular imaging. So it can make a big difference for family members.
Yes, I'm concerned about my grandchildren. However, I've told my girls to be extra vigilant, you know, but I know that's not the same as having the genetic testing and finding out one way or the other.
Correct.
So, but I have held off doing it because of the obligation, I feel anyway, to tell my first cousins. And I think that's as far as I have to go in telling people,
right,
children, siblings,
right,
and first cousins. All right. Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome, Maureen.
Well, I also appreciate your time, Doctor. We are out of time, and thank you very much for being with us. Terrific job. And just, is there one brief message you'd like to get across here to those who may be wondering about their status?
I think that there is a lot of misinformation and confusion about mammograms. I would strongly encourage women starting at the age of 40 to get a yearly mammogram, discuss it with your physician. And I think also as we get older, talk to your physician about whether you should continue getting a yearly mammogram after the age of 75, depending on your health. But knowledge is power. Breast cancer is treatable if detected early. And we have all kinds of new technologies out there. It's not a death sentence. It's not a chronic condition for a lot of people who get diagnosed with breast cancer early on. There's a lot of hope there.
Dr. Lisa Curcio, beautiful job. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Support comes from Columbia Memorial Health, promoting healthy communities for their neighbors by providing comprehensive, personalized care for patients in Columbia, Greene, and Dutchess counties. ColumbiaMemorialHealth.org. Once again, thanks to Dr. Lisa Curcio of New Vance Health for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Joe Makowicz took the calls. Our producers, Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Star Wars. That's right. It's a Star Wars show. May the 4th be with you. Oh, God, what next? Battlestar Galactica? Hey, you never know. Stand by for the Media Project.